So here we are on a rainy April 11th, 2017. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on corporations and democracy are those of our guests and of the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Well, today we're going to do the program in two halves again. In the first half, we'll discuss what the Food and Drug Administration may look like under the Trump administration. And that'll be with Dr. Michael Carome. He's the director of health research of the Health Research Group at Public Citizen. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll discuss Global Exchange's list of top 10 corporate criminals for 2016. That's with Jenny White, one of the volunteers there at Global Exchange. So, Michael Carome, MD, is the director of the Health Research Group at Public Citizen. He's an expert on issues of drug and medical device safety, pharmacy compounding, Food and Drug Administration oversight, healthcare policy, and the protection of human research subjects. He retired from the U.S. Public Health Service in 2010 as a captain after more than 24 years in the service. In the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, he was Associate Director for Regulatory Affairs at their Office for Human Research Protections. And that's where he became an internationally recognized expert on the protection of human research subjects. He was also a staff nephrologist at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center's Department of Medicine and a guest researcher at the Renal Cell Biology Section of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases at the National Institute of Health. There's a mouthful for you. So, Carome is also now a fellow in the American College of Physicians. He's been quoted in numerous national magazines and major newspapers, in addition to being a guest on National Public Radio and NBC Nightly News. So, let's look at what the Food and Drug Administration may look like under the Trump administration. Dr. Michael Carome, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate you taking the time. We know you're on your way out of town, and thank you for hanging in for a half hour here to talk to us. President Trump has been meeting with executives from the biggest pharmaceutical companies in order to streamline, in quotes, Food and Drug Administration regulations. So what is actually going on here?
So, you know, as we have seen in many other areas, such as the oil and gas industry and the banking and financial sector, President Trump has advocated a deregulatory agenda, and he favors the interests of big business over the welfare of average citizens and public health. And so it's not surprising that he would take a similar approach to the pharmaceutical and medical device industries, which are regulated by the FDA. And of note, during his second week in office, he met with senior executives from several major pharmaceutical companies, and he promised to slash federal regulations from 9,000 pages to 100 pages and to cut FDA regulations in particular, you know, by 75 to 80%, streamline the FDA, and accelerate the agency's review process. And, you know, such promises, if fulfilled, would fundamentally weaken, if not destroy, the ability of the FDA to protect patients and consumers from unsafe and or ineffective medications and medical devices, as well as hazardous foods and dietary supplements, dangerous tobacco products, among many other things. You know, they regulate approximately a quarter of the nation's economy. And the end result of all of that would be countless preventable deaths, injuries, and illnesses across this country. You know, his fact-free rants that he made at that meeting with the pharmaceutical executives about reducing regulations really reflect utter ignorance about the agency's essential role in protecting public health, and really once again demonstrates the president's commitment to placing corporate profits above protecting the safety of the American people.
So that's pretty astounding. He's going to try to shake down the 9,000 pages of regulations to 100, what do you think would be left, just enough to hold together the shell of the structure?
Yeah, again, I think he is someone who really doesn't understand regulation, doesn't really know what's in the important regulations that make sure our water is safe, our air is clean, and our drugs and medical devices are safe and effective before we expose patients to them. And so he's just ignorant about what's really in these regulations. His numbers of how many pages there are probably aren't even accurate. And so this is sort of par for the course in someone who's spouting rants about regulation without really understanding their importance or what they actually say.
So you've been speaking out against Trump's nominee for commissioner of the FDA, Dr. Scott Gottlieb. Who is Gottlieb?
So Dr. Gottlieb is the least bad of three or four people
that's
whose
good to
names
know.
You know, were floated as potential candidates to be FDA commissioner soon after Trump's election. And, you know, at a superficial level, if you look at his credentials, you know, he appears to have, you know, a reasonable credentials to be FDA commissioner. He's a physician. He trained in internal medicine. He previously worked at the FDA during the Bush administration, including serving as a deputy commissioner from 2005 to 2007. So sort of on the basis of those characteristics, he might appear to be a reasonable choice. But if you dig below the surface, you find that Dr. Gottlieb is entangled in an unprecedented web of ties to Big Pharma and other FDA-regulated companies. And he spent most of his career dedicated to promoting the financial interests of pharmaceutical and other medical product companies. And for example, in 2007, up until the present time, he's been what's called a venture partner with New Enterprise Associates, and that is a company that proclaims itself to be the world's largest and most active venture capital firm. And according to that firm's website, the company invests in biopharmaceuticals, medical devices, and healthcare services, among many other things. Moreover, at the time of his nomination, Dr. Gottlieb was serving or had recently served on the boards of several pharmaceutical companies, including what's called the Product Investment Board of GlaxoSmithKline, which is one of the world's largest drug companies. Also, according to a federal database called the Open Payments Database, which tracks industry payments to physicians, from August 2013, when the database began operating, until December 2015, which is the last time the data is currently available, Dr. Gottlieb received a total of more than $400,000 from multiple drug and medical device companies, including Pfizer, AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, and others. Most of that was for consulting and speaking fees. And there have also been media reports that since 2015 to early 2017, he's received an additional $200,000 or so in payments from multiple companies. So what this tells us is that Dr. Gottlieb really has been a shill for the pharmaceutical industry for many years, and these financial and business relationships no doubt are going to frame his thinking and approach to the FDA in a way that's undoubtedly going to be industry-friendly.
Well, he's involved with like more than 20 companies, I guess, but he argues that, well, he can recuse himself from all the companies that he has ties to.
Sure. I think he said his confirmation hearing before the Senate Help Committee was last week, and he really engaged in some remarkable, what I would call, intellectual gymnastics in trying to sort of explain away and respond to the harsh criticism he was receiving, particularly from the Democratic side, about these industry ties. And what he said was that his work with the industry and investing in medical technology projects have taught him, quote, the need for an absolutely objective regulatory watchdog over this field. And if confirmed, he will lead the FDA as an impartial and passionate advocate for public health. And really, those are remarkable words. He's basically put forth the best argument for why he should not be the FDA commissioner. I mean, given his long history of ties to the pharma industry and the likelihood that he will actually return to those business relationships upon leaving the agency through the revolving door that exists, it's really impossible for him to be an absolutely objective regulatory watchdog over the field. And no amount of recusals from among, you know, regarding the various, you know, two dozen or so companies that he said in his ethics disclosure letter that he'll recuse himself from, no amount of recusals are going to really address these conflicts of interest. You know, he says, you know, all right, I'm going to recuse myself from any particular matters regarding these two dozen or so companies. So that means, you know, if he won't be involved in approving, say, a drug from a particular drug company. But typically, these types of particular matters don't rise to the desk of the FDA commissioner. But what does come to the desk of the FDA commissioner are numerous broad policy and regulatory decisions that will impact the financial bottom lines of many of the companies he's been tied to for years. And again, so no amount of recusals is going to disentangle himself from these conflicts of interest.
During the questioning, did any of the Democrats ask him about the Trump idea of reducing the amount of regulations down to almost nothing? Was he asked about that?
He wasn't specifically asked about that, although some of the members did note that, you know, that he said he's going to recuse himself from particular matters. But they raised this point I just made. They asked him, you know, well, you're going to be involved in broader policy deliberations that will impact the companies you have ties to. And so are you planning to recuse yourself from those decisions? And he basically demurred. He said he didn't answer that question.
Given the span of his connections, it sounds like he'd have to recuse himself from everything. And maybe... Maybe Gottlieb is another example of a head of a department that is appointed in order to dismantle it.
Sounds like the review of these 9,000 pages sounds like a Trump-level review, which is you make the claim you're going to cut it down to 100 pages before you read any of them. Kind of like the Obamacare versus Trump care, you know?
Absolutely. I think the comments like that reflect great ignorance about public health policy in the area of the FDA in the same way he's demonstrated in multiple areas. In terms of whether Gottlieb is someone who would dismantle the agency, like we've seen perhaps with the head of the EPA and a couple of other agencies, I think Gottlieb is probably not as extreme as that. He's certainly not signaled a desire to dismantle the agency, and I think that would just be difficult to do and probably impossible to get through even this Congress. However, in prior writings over the past several years, Dr. Gottlieb has staked out a number of positions, troubling positions, that if they were implemented, they would weaken the FDA's review process for approving new medicines and other products. It's important to recognize that even already the FDA review process for new drugs allows for some degree of uncertainty about whether drugs are safe and effective. And over the last couple of decades, the pendulum has swung towards speedier approvals over evidence that these products are safe and effective. But Gottlieb has argued that the agency needs to tolerate even greater degrees of uncertainty about drug safety and effectiveness at the time of approval in exchange for getting drugs faster to market. And what that means is, sort of in industry speak, is it means that the agency should base its decisions about new drug approvals on less evidence that the products are safe and effective. And that type of approach really rejects a key public health principle, which is one of being cautious. It's called the precautionary principle, in which public health and being cautious about things that might harm the public take priority. Other things that he's done and advocated for, he's favored looser restrictions on what's called off-label promotion, which is allowing pharmaceutical and medical device companies to push their devices, their products, for uses that have not been approved by the FDA. So those are some of the things that I think reflect a deregulatory process. So it doesn't involve completely dismantling the agency, but it involves weakening it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's clearly speed over safety. What is the status of him, his nomination right now? He's had his hearings before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, And I guess he showed himself well as far as the Republicans are concerned and did poorly as far as the Democrats are concerned. Is that safe to say?
I think so. I think he successfully skated through the HELP committee confirmation hearing last week. You know, Republican senators were effusive in their praise for him, and Democrats in general were critical of his ties to industry. I think, you know, given what we've seen already with the history of cabinet appointments and confirmation votes for nominees in this administration, where we've had multiple people who have serious conflict of interest regarded to the agencies they've been nominated for and or a lack of expertise regarding the agency, I think, unfortunately, it's likely that Dr. Gottlieb will be confirmed. Now, the date for the HELP committee vote and the floor vote in the Senate have not been announced. Senator Lamar Alexander, the chair of the HELP committee, he announced at the end of Dr. Gottlieb's confirmation hearing that it will be at least 2 weeks before the committee would vote in order to allow members to thoroughly consider Gottlieb's record. So it's going to be probably at least a couple more weeks from now, but it's likely this will be a priority when Congress returns from its current break.
And you mentioned earlier something about how big this industry is. So we're talking about, do you want to give us kind of a ballpark figure? What are we talking about
one
here?
One quarter of the economy?
Yeah, you said something.
So that's for all of the industries that the FDA regulates. Mm-hmm. So that includes drugs, medical devices, dietary supplements, cosmetics, foods, tobacco products. So it is a huge responsibility. It requires a leader who is going to be independent and not be swayed by pressure from industry and someone who doesn't have these close ties to industry.
So while we're lucky enough to have you here, you've been covering the industry for Public Citizen for over 5 years, and I wonder if you could tell us some stories about some of the industry problems that you're really concerned with, ones that you've covered or uncovered in some cases. What are some of the things that are foremost in your mind?
Sure. So sort of in terms of clinical trials that are conducted, you know, there are thousands of clinical trials conducted every year throughout the U.S. and around the globe. And one problem that we see as a watchdog consumer group is, unfortunately, not infrequently, trials that are conducted in an unethical manner. And those could be both industry-sponsored clinical trials, such as those funded by pharmaceutical companies, as well as trials funded by the federal government, such as trials funded and sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. And among the types of problems that we have seen, we see trials that are poorly designed and which expose human subjects to unacceptable levels of avoidable risk. We see trials in which control subjects are given a placebo for a very serious disease when there is known standard therapy available to treat that disorder or condition. And doing so puts those control subjects at risk. Too often we see where the informed consent process for clinical trials is inadequate. Sometimes subjects are not told about the experimental nature of the research they're enrolled in, or the potential benefits of the research may be exaggerated. And on the opposite side, important risks often are minimized or not disclosed. And what that leads to is a consent process that is not informed, and patients unwittingly participate in research not fully understanding the nature of the research, what the true benefits are, and perhaps most importantly, what the true risks are. So those are some of the key things that we've seen in sort of the clinical trial realm. On the downside, after trials are completed, it's not uncommon for publications of clinical trials sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry, you know, often provide a biased, misleading picture about a drug's purported benefits and its safety. It's not uncommon for information to be withheld regarding the true side effects and adverse events of a particular drug. And so the industry is constantly trying to paint their products in the most favorable light, and they do that through scientific publications of their work. So those are some of the key issues and problems we've seen regarding clinical trials.
May I call that selective scientific publication of their results?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. And often, you know, drug companies will conduct several trials of a particular drug product that they're developing, and you know, some might show that the drug works and some might show that it doesn't work. And obviously the ones that show it worked are the ones they're going to highlight in both publications and in their promoting the product to doctors and to patients.
Well, let me pry a little bit. Are they required to reveal the studies that show that that they don't work? You know, the bad news, is that something that's required by the FDA? Or?
So there is a federally mandated database called clinicaltrials.gov, in which all clinical trials of drugs and medical devices need to be disclosed and described in that database so the public can see. And then once the trials are completed after a certain period of time, particularly after a drug or device is approved or cleared for marketing, then the results need to be made publicly available. So in theory, yes, this type of information, there should be transparency about it. But there have been studies showing that too often these requirements are not being met.
It's hard to talk about this subject without talking about the high cost of prescription drugs. Do you have some observations on that problem?
Absolutely. So, you know, consumers in the U.S. pay more for prescription drugs than in any other country in the world. And that includes all the other, you know, developed and wealthy countries, you know, our counterparts. And drug companies basically recognize that in the U.S., they can charge whatever the free market will bear. And so in recent years, you know, the public has been outraged by a number of disclosures of some extraordinary spikes in medicines, some very old medicines, as well as excessive costs for many new medicines. And, for example, in 2013, the pharmaceutical company Gilead, you know, they made headlines when they came out with their first drug for treating hepatitis C called Sovaldi. And it went on the market for $1,000 per pill, which translates into $84,000 for a full 12-week course. They came out with another hepatitis C virus drug in 2014, and that one cost more than $1,100 per pill, or $94,000 per course of treatment. And then in August of 2015, Turing Pharmaceuticals bought the exclusive rights to an antibiotic called Daraprim, for which there was no generic competitors. It had been on the available since 1953, and it's the mainstay of treatment for a potentially life-threatening parasite infection called toxoplasmosis. And after it bought the rights of this drug, the company Turing immediately jacked up the price from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill, a 55-fold increase. And that would have increased the course of treatment, the cost of a course of treatment for toxoplasmosis to more than $600,000 per year for some patients. So these types of price spikes are just what has driven a lot of the outrage. But people don't realize that these, you know, the companies in general, they steadily have been raising their prices overall at rates that far exceed the rate of inflation. And so we actually, Public Citizen put out a report today in which we surveyed the top 28 pharmaceutical companies to see if they would match a pledge made by the pharmaceutical company Allergan to limit their price increases to single digits, which is less than 10% a year, which is still far above the recent rate of inflation. Mm-hmm. And Allergan announced its intent to do that in September. And then three other companies that we surveyed agreed to that limit, but the rest did not. So these price increases are a serious problem, and fortunately, in late March, Senators Al Franken and Sherrod Brown, along with 40 other Democrats, introduced a bill that would address the price problem, the drug price problem in this country in multiple ways. And so that's a key bill that really needs to move forward.
Well, that's all just so unbelievable. It's like a nightmare. We're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you about some of the press that's that we're hearing about people dying from prescription drug overdoses or misuse or something, that that's like a national problem?
Certainly. So since 1999, the number of overdose deaths involving opioids, which includes both prescription opioids like OxyContin and heroin, quadrupled. And in 2015, opioids killed more than 33,000 people in the U.S., which was more than in any other prior year, and that's the most recent year we have data for. And this opioid prescription epidemic and the deaths related to it has been driven in large part by the aggressive promotion of opioid prescription drugs by the pharmaceutical industry. And in some cases, they have promoted these drugs illegally for off-label uses, for treating like types of chronic pain conditions for which the drugs were not approved and shown to be safe and effective. And the same companies have overestimated the benefits of the drugs and underestimated the risks of addiction and other complications. So the industry has played a key role in driving this epidemic.
Well, I want to thank you so much for all your time and information today. We've been talking to Dr. Michael Carome, that's C-A-R-O-M-E, Director of Health Research Group at Public Citizen, and that's probably the best place for people to find you is to go to publiccitizen.org?
That's right. www.citizen.org is the best place to find out about us.
Might there be information there about that bill that you mentioned?
Absolutely. It's one, we put out a press release back on March 29th. If you search our press release page, you'll find links to all you need to know about the bill.
Super.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll catch up with you later and find out what's going on after they do some more work on restructuring the FDA.
And again,
citizen.org
for the information. Okay, thanks for being with us.
Bye. Okay.